B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, January 30th, 2018. The mainstream media is all agog. The ritual State of the Union address will occur tonight, a joint session of Congress with the Orange Cheeto presiding. And it's mostly a waste of time. The president will pat himself on the back, take credit for the Obama economic recovery that he is enjoying and taking credit for. And he'll lay out a laundry list of applause lines that the Republicans will rally to and Democrats will grimace at. And then it will be over. There's a lot of grandstanding going on. Different members of Congress are bringing different guests to score political points with the viewers at home. And based on a little Facebook poll that my friend David Earnhardt did, most people like you will be watching something else or just not in front of the tube tonight. And that's okay because, they're going to make a big deal that Melania will come out of seclusion after sucking her thumb regarding the Stormy Daniels exposure and other perfidy of her hubby. And the other interesting note is that the Trump campaign is going to live stream the speech on its website, and the graphics on the screen will give credit to people who have donated to the campaign of the guy who said he was going to pay for it all, and that way nobody could buy him, he wouldn't owe anybody a dime. So he's turning the State of the Union into a kind of infomercial telethon fundraiser. It's different. Yeah, it is. And it's pretty disgusting. So behind the scenes, the knives will be out in the joint session tonight as the parallel tracks of the Democratic investigation into so-called Russian meddling in the election that gave us Trump and the Republicans' increasing allegations that the FBI was inappropriately used, the FISA court was lied to, and therefore, this whole thing should just be shut down. And of course, I'm somewhere uncomfortably squeezed in the middle here, because I'm interested in seeing the Devin Nunes memo. We've been told for weeks it's 4 pages. We're now told it's 3.5. And it essentially argues that the FISA court gave the warrant to surveil Carter Page based on the Trump dossier that came from the Clinton campaign. And I believe that is probably the case. We haven't seen the FISA court applications. One, we're told, was rejected. Then a second was accepted. And the Democrats continue to press their line of inquiry and their allegations that Russia meddled in the election without providing really any public proof. And so the Nunes memo has been approved by the Republican majority of the House Intelligence Committee. It triggers a clock for up to 5 days for the Trump administration to review this, and it could pocket the memo and decline to release it. But Trump has indicated that he wants it out. And while I do believe that we need a top-to-bottom investigation of the FBI and the CIA and the NSA. These moves by Republicans are the right moves, but for the wrong reasons. Because they're only interested in roughing up the FBI, for example, to the extent that they can use that to dismiss the Trump allegations. And they're not really interested in getting to the bottom of anything. And to be fair, neither are the Democrats, who are now embracing the FBI and other elements of law enforcement and intelligence in ways that make me equally nauseous. We've got Mark Warner, top Democrat, Senate Intelligence Committee, says the memo was connecting dots that don't connect. He said it's part of a coordinated effort to impede the Russia investigation. And as I discussed with Ray McGovern in our conversation that I released yesterday, no subscription required, It is fascinating to see this play out because Trump could have declassified selective information about this for over a year now. Obama had months when he could have declassified information that would have shed light on these murky allegations. And neither one of them has. And so this plays out against the backdrop of making America great again and the big win of the tax cuts that are going to trickle down and stimulate our economy, and Apple's going to bring all that money home and hire Americans. I mean, that's the kind of game that we're going to hear in Washington tonight. But the deadly struggle that is being waged by these well-dressed politicians as they mud wrestle with the Constitution is, you know, what really matters here. So the Speaker of the House, Republican Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, defended the way the Intelligence Committee handled this divisive vote to publicize the memo, but he is warning against using it to discredit the special counsel's probe of Russian meddling into the election. Now that's speaking out of both sides of your mouth. Now the House Intelligence Committee also voted to make the Democratic memo. We don't know anything about what it says, but it's going to be now shared with all House members if they go to a SCIF, a compartmentalized room, to read it. And perhaps down the road it will be released as well, but we have no assurance of that at this point. So this is a very messy situation. And it draws me to my big picture question. Because both sides, you know, claim that Russia had undue influence of some sort. The Republicans say it was via the Steele dossier. The Democrats say it was hacking the DNC. But if the central points of the Steele dossier, and this game keeps being played where it's uncorroborated, it's unproven, well, either prove it or disprove it, but it's been out for over a year now, and the idea that it's still in that gray zone is just ridiculous. At any rate, my big question is, why do they need schlubs like George Papadopoulos and Carter Page to open the door to connections to the Kremlin when you got Paul Manafort there? It doesn't make any sense. And if Trump actually was compromised back in 2013 with the P-tape, the golden showers, well, he still wouldn't need Carter Page or George Papadopoulos to forge a connection with Putin. And so there are so many really obvious and fundamental questions that are overlooked or remain unanswered as each side pursues its partisan approach. And there is a helpful timeline published by Philip Bump at the Washington Post today. And I say helpful because it does provide an interesting way to analyze the sequence of events. It's also curious because it promotes the Washington Post Russiagate narrative at every stage, and it doesn't allow for any alternate theories, you know, like who hacked the DNC. So it also does help us, for example, reject one claim from Trump, and that was that recently departed deputy director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, was compromised because his wife was running for public office in the state of Virginia. And she got financial help from Terry McAuliffe, the governor there and the longtime bagman for the Clintons. And that is not any kind of a realistic connection because McCabe didn't take the deputy director's post until 3 months after his wife lost that election. And so, you know, it's just one of those guilt by association efforts, and Trump desperately, you know, uses that whenever he can. Also, the timeline notes that Fusion GPS was hired by the Clinton campaign, but they didn't note that it was done on a stealth basis. So Mark Elias, the attorney, actually paid the Fusion GPS bills and it wasn't disclosed until October of 17, yes, just a few months ago, who paid for the Fusion GPS investigation and the Steele dossier. The other interesting date that we get is that Christopher Steele was not hired by Fusion GPS until June 20th. In the past, it has appeared that that happened in late April. And so his investigation, his collection of information, moved very quickly because we are then told that it was in July, early July, when Christopher Steele contacted his friends at the FBI about these things he had discovered about Carter Page meeting in Moscow just a couple of weeks before that. And so it is helpful to lay these out on a timeline. But for example, the critical information about the date of the FISA court application that was rejected and then the second that was approved, we don't know. It's just listed as summer. At some point, the FBI obtains a warrant to surveil Page. Now, why is that not a discernible, an identifiable, a quantifiable issue? I mean, people know that. The date of the hearing is not secret or sensitive, and it would help us a lot to find out whether the contact from Steele to the FBI occurred in time for the Steele dossier to be used in the FISA court proceedings. And were they honest with the FISA court about whatever other information was being presented and differentiating between real intelligence and paid political muckraking? And here's an interesting item. October 31st, the New York Times reports that the FBI doesn't see a clear link to Russia in Russiagate. This is October 31st of 2016. According to later testimony from the founder of Fusion GPS, this alarms Christopher Steele, prompts him to cut off contact with the FBI. And so, number one, there's an acknowledgement that at that late a date, the intelligence was still very sketchy and did not lead to a conclusion by the New York Times. Now, we don't know what they saw. We don't know who leaked what to them and who didn't. So it is fascinating to see it broken down this way. And one thing that I learned from this is that on May 10th of last year, Trump called Andy McCabe to chastise him for allowing Jim Comey to return to Washington from Los Angeles on an FBI plane. As you may know, Comey was sacked. He found out he'd been fired while he was giving a talk to FBI agents in L.A., and he saw it on a TV monitor in the back of the room. And then Trump wanted him to hitchhike back to Washington? I mean, that is just so petty. And silly, too. So there's more in the timeline. I've linked to it for you to review yourselves. And it doesn't necessarily prove much, but it does add a context and a little bit of new information to this whole saga. And today, The Guardian is reporting that there was a second dossier. And it's not clear whether this was commissioned and paid for by Fusion GPS or if Cody Shearer, a former journalist who was close to the Clinton White House back in the 90s, did this on his own. The article infers that Shearer is wealthy and didn't have to be paid to do this. He shared his findings with select media organizations in October of 16 and gave it to the FBI in October of 16. I don't know why we are first hearing about this now from a British-based newspaper. And despite the fact they've had it for 15 months, The Guardian has been told the FBI investigation is still assessing details in the Shearer memo and pursuing intriguing leads, but we are told in a titillating manner that it appears to corroborate the golden shower scene. So this is new. And the details here are not very rich. So there isn't much more I can tell you about it at this point, but we'll continue to keep an eye open for it. Yesterday, I released a conversation with Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst, founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, longtime contributor to Bob Perry's Consortium News website. And after we talked, Ray wrote a brief piece asking the question, will Congress face down the deep state? Now, Ray is a little more convinced that we're at a breaking point here. He calls it the denouement. And he says that ordinarily the deep state, the intelligence establishment, prevails in any kind of a conflict with the little politicians who come and go. He writes, past precedent suggests that the cabal that conjured up Russiagate will not have to pick up a go-to-jail card. This despite the widespread guilt suggested by the abrupt way that several senior echelon justice and FBI rats have already jumped ship. And he notes yesterday's unceremoniously overboard push of Andy McCabe. And Ray writes a little later here, there seems to be an outside chance that the culprits who did actually interfere in the 2016 presidential election in an effort to make sure Trump could not win and then did all in their powers to sabotage him after he won will be held to account by unusually feisty members of the House. We will see. We will see. Meanwhile, and this could give you whiplash, I'm warning you right now, Mike Pompeo, celebrating his one-year anniversary as director of the CIA, gave an interview to the BBC. Okay. He probably doesn't talk to CNN. Anyway, he said that he fully expects Russia to try to disrupt November's midterm elections, a message completely at odds with the White House claim that further sanctions against Moscow are not necessary. Pompeo said Russia continues to interfere in U.S. domestic policies. He had every expectation the Kremlin will target the midterms. I haven't seen a significant decrease in their activity, he said, fear-mongering. And Pompeo told the BBC that although he's wary of Moscow's efforts, he has faith in his country's ability to ward off attempts to interfere. Quote, I have every expectation that they will continue to try to do that, but I'm confident that America will be able to have a free and fair election, and we will push back in a way that is sufficiently robust that the impact they have on our election won't be great. What the hell does that mean? And what have we done to diminish any attempted hacking? Of course, I am concerned about domestic suspects much more than international ones, but hey, that's just me. And the article about Pompeo there referenced that last night, the State Department, in compliance with the congressional sanctions against Russia and potentially other countries that were passed in the middle of last summer, well, they responded and they respected a demand from that sanctions law that the administration publish a list of wealthy Russians and those who they believe are tied to Putin. But at the same time, they issued this statement declining to impose the sanctions that were passed by Congress and signed into law by the president. Now, I don't support these sanctions because there's been no proof that Russia meddled in the election, and for Congress to punish Russia without proving that Russia did what is asserted, I think is just crazy. But over at the State Department, a spokeswoman said, we have informed Congress that this legislation and its implementation are deterring Russian defense sales. Since the enactment of the legislation, we estimate that foreign governments have abandoned planned or announced purchases of several billion dollars in Russian defense acquisitions. Huh? That's not what the sanctions law was about. It was supposed to be punishment for election meddling, right? And so this is incoherent. It's out of compliance with the law that was passed by veto-proof majorities in both houses. And so we are left to simply scratch our heads and say, huh? And then this list of 114 politicians and 96 oligarchs appears to be largely drawn from public information from Forbes magazine on wealthy Russians and the website of the Kremlin. And Putin is disappointed that he didn't make the list. But his, his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, is on the list, said that this is a direct and obvious attempt by the U.S. to influence Russia's presidential elections coming up in March. How about that? Tit for tat. The New York Times describes it as angering both Moscow and Washington. The State Department angered members of Congress by announcing it won't impose new sanctions called for in the measure that Trump reluctantly signed into law last year. And Putin is reported to be pretty pissed about this, and he said Moscow had pondered virtually breaking ties with Washington, but has decided to refrain from such steps for the time being. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Find people like Daryl McElhinney, who just renewed his annual subscription. Thanks, Derek. Did I say Daryl? Derek, I'm sorry. Wendy Gebauer, Cynthia Von Hendricks, and Abby McMillan. Those three ladies are all monthly supporters of this podcast, and I encourage you to join them. Maybe you should pause this podcast for a moment as you visit peterbcollins.com and you click on menu, click on become a subscriber, you get to the sign-up page, and you can make an easy decision about what level of support fits your budget. I hope you'll do that so I can continue my independent reporting and commentary here at peterbcollins.com. I've been remiss because there's been so much distraction, so much going on domestically, but it's a bloodbath in Afghanistan these days, and we are still there. It's 2018. We invaded in 2002. We're heading into 16 years of our occupation of the graveyard of empires. And in just recent days, fighters reported to be aligned with the Islamic State killed 11 Afghan soldiers, wounded 15 more when they attacked a military academy in Kabul. This was just 2 days after the Taliban carried out a massive bombing in the capital's secure zone that killed more than 100 people, the most deadly attack in the last 7 or 8 months. And you may recall that it used to be that the fighters in Afghanistan took the winter off. It's too difficult to fight in the winter climate there, but not this year. And it appears that the Taliban and the Islamic State are not coordinated, but they just continue to blow things up. January 20th, the attack on the Kabul Hotel Intercontinental was attributed to the Taliban, 22 people killed. And then a couple of days later in Jalalabad, the Islamic State took claim of an attack on the offices of Save the Children. Now, in reaction to this carnage, Trump made some comments yesterday that completely contradict his scheme for adding more troops and letting the generals run the war in Afghanistan. Because what he said is, we're not going to talk to the Taliban because of this recent round of violence. He didn't mention the Islamic State. But that is the central point of the alleged strategy that Trump has articulated for Afghanistan. And I've linked to a great analytical piece by our friend Gareth Porter that appeared at Truth Out on January 25th, entitled, How the Pentagon Enlisted Trump to Continue Its Perpetual War on Terror. And Porter focuses largely on Afghanistan, but also Syria and Iraq as well. And he notes that while Trump talked a good game about being against regime change wars, he has made a point of listening to his generals, and he surrounded himself with more generals than any president in modern history, I think, since World War II. And Porter notes that the U.S. has already made a commitment to keep a military presence in Syria for the foreseeable future, and the same is true in Afghanistan. And he describes how the generals teamed up. And after Steve Bannon, who was against an escalation in Afghanistan, was bounced from the administration, there was a meeting at Camp David with General Mattis, General McMaster, and General Dunford, where, according to Porter, they pressed their advantage, and Trump's opposing stance to intervention dissolved completely. He describes Trump as a pushover in that encounter. I encourage you to read it. It's got a lot of great information. The other war that Porter comments on, vis-a-vis Trump, is the war in Syria, where Turkey has now taken an aggressive stance in cracking down on the Kurds. And this is part of Erdogan's strategy of trying to marginalize Kurdish factions in his own country. But it's gotten really nasty on the Turkey-Syria border. And it is the Kurdish fighters, including females, who have been the most effective proxy fighters on behalf of the United States, and they fear that we will abandon them at any moment, which is likely. It's just a matter of when. And the Times reported on January 28th, a female Kurdish fighter carried out what appeared to be a suicide bombing attack on the Turkish military in Syria, destroying a tank and killing several soldiers. Now, what is fascinating here is that the YPG, which is the Kurdish Popular Protection Units, and the female component, which is the YPJ, they practice a pure form of democracy. And this is not a secret. Their community in along the Syria-Turkish border is described as Rojava or Rogova. And the supporters there have an officially secular political setup based on the democratic confederalist principles of socialism, gender equality, and ecological sustainability. So these are the people we should be creating heroes of, that we should be identifying as the way forward in this region where the United States has instigated regime change wars one after the other. Here in the Bay Area, we're often derided because the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit, is considered excessively liberal. Well, the uber-liberal court ruled yesterday that minors who enter the country without authorization have no right to a lawyer provided by the government. And I can't understand this. The Ninth Circuit is saying that immigration judges can represent the interests of children before them in their courts without a lawyer. And this is bullshit. A study by the ACLU, it's a government report cited by the ACLU, showed that when lawyers are present, 47% of minors will win a court ruling in their favor. But without them, only 10% do. And we know that there are massive caseloads in these immigration courts, huge backlogs. The judges are overwhelmed. And the idea that they can represent the interests of child number 410 who comes before them on a given day? This is outrageous. The court even weighed in saying, well, it might cost too much money. Puerto Rico is still just vanquished by the hurricanes that hammered it last summer. That would be Maria and Irma. And the country is going on a debt payment holiday for 5 years. The governor is threatening to privatize the troubled utility, Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, PREPA. And they are just locked down because PREPA, its utility infrastructure, was aging and unmaintained, and it crumbled even further after the hurricane. But the FEMA law says that FEMA money can only be used to reconstitute what was there, which was inadequate and crumbling. And the only way it appears to go forward and rebuild the utility infrastructure in Puerto Rico is to privatize it, because the Congress will not give them the money they need. There's only $2 or $3 billion that is, here it is, $4.9 billion is the total amount of disaster relief, and that is in the form of a loan. And they made it a loan because the government of Puerto Rico is not completely broke yet. They had a couple of billion dollars in several accounts. So they're treating it like a welfare queen. And it's just, it's obscene, and it's a bipartisan obscenity. Finally today, I want to note some of the fine obituaries and great memories that have been shared about Robert Perry, who died last Saturday at the age of 68. And our friend Norman Solomon wrote a beautiful piece. I've linked to all of these that I'm going to mention. His was published yesterday at thenation.com. And he notes that Seymour Hersh commented on Bob Perry's passing. Cy Hersh said, "I ran into Bob more than 3 decades ago when he was the first to warn of the Iran-Contra affair. He was widely seen over the next years as a critic of the mainstream American media. That was not so. He was a critic of lousy reporting, be it in Pravda or the New York Times. He wanted every journalist everywhere to do the research and the interviewing that it takes to get beyond the accepted headline." And Solomon notes that Bob Perry refused to take on faith the official story, whether from government or news outlets. And he describes how he worked with Bob Perry on a piece defining Colin Powell way back in 1996. And he says, "Bob Perry was notably non-ideological. What propelled him was a moral core and determination to follow the facts. That devotion led him to expose the lethal deceptions and machinations of Reagan-era figures like Oliver North, Elliot Abrams, and Caspar Weinberger. 3 decades later, the same resolve to separate fact from spun fiction put him on a collision course with the conventional wisdom of Russiagate." And Stephen Cohen, the contributing editor at The Nation and a Russia scholar, said, "Very often alone, exposed those malpractices, especially those committed by the powerful New York Times and Washington Post, misreported story by misreported story, sometimes daily. For this, he was ostracized, slurred, certainly ignored by mainstream media." And if you take a look at the kind of thin obituary published in his hometown newspaper, The Washington Post, you'll see that payback in sharp relief. Because Bob Perry was a relentless critic of the editorial page operator at the Post, Fred Hyatt. But at Alternet, Jefferson Morley writes in detail about his work with Bob Perry back in the 1980s, and there's rich description about how hard it was to break the Iran-Contra story, particularly at the Reagan-aligned New Republic. So I encourage you to read that piece. There's a lot of good information there. And even the New York Times did him justice. In reviewing the life and work of Bob Perry, I learned for the first time that he came from a publishing family. His dad, William Perry, was the publisher of the Middlesex Daily News in Farmingham, Massachusetts. And while Bob only worked there a little bit before he was hired by the Associated Press, that's where he met his wife, who is Diane Dustin. And we also learn a little bit more that the New York Times was willing to share with its readers that Bob Perry didn't buy the New York Times reporting on Russiagate. Now, they didn't personalize it, but it reads like this: "After decades of enraging conservatives, Mr. Perry began angering liberals in 2016 by suggesting that Russian meddling had had little influence on the election of Donald J. Trump." Now, that's not really what he wrote, but at least they acknowledged it in a half-assed way. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. It's available free every day, and I invite you to share it with absolutely everybody you know. And you can find it on YouTube. Did you know that? I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.